Stay tuned for The Turning Point with Mike Fader. Again, home broadcast number four, I think it is. Is it already? Yeah. And every night when I go to bed, I kneel down at the side of the bed and I pray to the Lord to God bless mommy and daddy and to give us a new radio studio so I can stop doing this from my living room. Nothing wrong with my living room. I like living in my living room. I live here. But yes, indeed. I am looking forward to a radio studio for PRN. Every once in a while, I get some people who write in and send me emails, the form of communication now, who ask me, can I just fade the opening theme song? I can understand that. I mean, people could get tired of it, I guess. People want me to fade down the opening theme song or just play the first 30 seconds or 45 seconds of it. I don't know. I never minded listening to the whole theme songs of radio shows. It didn't bother me that much, and it still doesn't bother me. When I listen to some radio shows that I like, and they play their entire theme song, I don't mind it. And somehow also I cannot do that to Nina Simone in that song. If I had a crummy theme song, then why would I? I would fade it down, but I can't do it. Looking at the news this week, which is something I try not to do, but I find myself drawn to it anyhow. One of the big stories, of course, was the image that probably almost everybody saw in this age of instant availability, generally, universally, of all images that are taken anywhere, even some that people don't want to be taken. These days, there's a problem with the cops. Lots of problems with the cops, and it's not just these days. I know. But one of the problems that the police are having these days, and it's stirring a lot of things up, and to me, it's kind of a blow for democracy and for evening up the score a little bit between the rights of citizens and the powers of the police. And what I'm referring to, of course, is the latest and starkest image is the video that somebody took on their cell phone. This is all because of these smartphones now. Somebody took a video on their smartphone of a police officer in South Carolina, North Charleston, South Carolina, shooting at a man eight times. I think he hit him five times in the back as he was running away. A white cop shooting a black man. There was some circumstances. There was a traffic stop. The cop had one story that the man had grabbed his taser. I don't know, whatever. I didn't follow that so much. But the stark images and what resonates, what is symbolic, is the astounding picture of the video, moving picture in real time that somebody shot, and we all saw it later on, of this cop shooting a man who was nowhere near him, nowhere near enough to him. He was not armed, and if he was armed, he was running away. Shot him in the back five times. Then he goes over after the guy's been hit. Clearly he was hit. I mean, sure, the cop could see blood, and he fell down to the ground. He was apparently rendered incapable of doing anything. And then he handcuffed his hands behind his back. Beyond words. Well, not beyond some people's words, but beyond words. And then there have been other images in the last couple of years of police officers shooting people who were unarmed, putting chokeholds on people and killing people, beating people up. I think a lot of this started way back in what was it? It was in the late 90s. Was it in the late 90s? Or maybe it was a little bit later than that. Out in California, where a man, black man, pulled over by mostly white cops, I think it was, who was, hauled out of his car or taken out of his car and then beaten and kicked so severely that, and it was captured on video. Somebody took a video of it. And a lot of times the police react. As you can imagine, the police would react, although it's none of their business to do this, but they don't like people filming them because it's their word against yours a lot of the times. When I was a probation officer, I used to hang around a lot in courts because I had to talk to judges or judges' clerks, and I sat in sometimes during my free time and listened to trials. And there was police testimony during trials, and it was always, the officer said that the perpetrator had done this and perpetrator had done that, and the jury or the judge was listening, and they almost always took the police officer's word. He was all spiffy and dressed up with all his medals on, and he had his uniform. He was the police. He was a man of authority. And of course, there's all kinds of complications to that, depending on who's listening. I mean, who the juror is, but they would clear through the jury to see if they could possibly determine who was unprejudiced, or if you're the prosecutor, you want somebody prejudiced against anybody you think is a wrongdoer, as much as you can get them on the jury. And if you're a defense lawyer, you want somebody who's on the jury who is more sympathetic. But it was always the cop's word. The cop said this, the cop said that. And very often, of course, there were no other witnesses to this. And if there were witnesses, they were intimidated or did not want to come forward. Now people take these images and either make them available to the press, put them on YouTube, or make them available to the authorities. And often the police officer's testimony is contradicted. In this case, the cop was, as far as I remember, he was instantly indicted for murder. Shot a man in the back running away. And of course, it's with all this stuff with Ferguson and everything else, it's the it's the same old story of white cops and black men generally, being beaten or killed by white cops. And there's this whole movement in the, and there was an article in the Times that citizens' videos raise questions on police claims. That's a polite way to put it. Rising use of cameras. Some of the cops, upon being filmed, would go after the people who were filming them and arrest them for obstruction of governmental justice or whatever, or seize the camera or smash it or grab it and take it away from somebody, which is, of course, illegal too. But is it legal to just point a camera at anybody and film them doing anything? You know, if you're a private citizen, it's not really legal to have somebody film you and post that film in a public place. Or, somebody could film you and send it to the authorities and claim you're a terrorist, I suppose, and it would be investigated. But there's all kinds of Supreme Court cases with still photographs, and I guess with moving pictures. You can't really film without permission, private citizens. You cannot do it. And these days, of course, it's not a question of just filming them for your own, like you would film them still photograph and show people like, this is a cute kid, or this is somebody I saw doing something funny when I went to Atlanta on vacation once. Now we're talking about filming people and taking still photographs of people, which can instantly be posted and sent all over the world. People who have no idea who this person is. It's none of their business who this person is. It can be made available. But it's interesting when it's a police officer. And the police officers now are some of them are saying, well, yeah, why not? You know, we're decent. We don't do this kind of thing. So put cameras on us. There is a movement. Some cops want it, maybe a lot don't, to put body cameras on all police officers, so that everything that they're doing can be verified by a second opinion, which is the opinion of the lens of the camera, which is absolutely fascinating when you think of trials and evidence and a police officer. But how that would work, I don't know. I mean, anything can be perverted, put it that way. Anything can be altered. I mean, a body camera on a police officer, who knows what the chain of evidence is, how it could be doctored up or anything. I don't know. But once again, the cops, and once again, white cops and black citizens. And, you know, it seems to me that it seems funny to me in a way, because a long, long, long time ago, and there's a long time in my life for me to say a long time ago at this point, I wanted to be a cop. That is the thing I wanted to be most in the world, was to be a police officer. That was when I was a teenager. I knew plenty of other kids in my neighborhood wanted to be, you know, doctors, lawyers. They wanted to just make money. They wanted to be businessmen, go into business for themselves. Some people wanted to help people, you know. This is before the 60s, right? And some people wanted to be scientists. Some people wanted to be, invent things. Other people want to be musicians, dancers, bankers, maybe. No, when I was a kid where I lived, nobody wanted to be a banker. That didn't really seem like anything interesting to do. But people did want to make money, you know, and they wanted to be lawyers and they wanted to be doctors and the usual. And a lot of them went on to be people in my kids in my neighborhood, lower middle class kids, studied hard. They became dentists, you know, became lawyers, became doctors. Some kids in other neighborhoods wanted to be cops, and they wound up being cops, detectives ultimately, or they wanted to join the fire department. That's because a lot of their relatives were in it. It was like a family business. I don't know what do kids want to be now. Kids want to be the same thing, right? Kids want to grow up. I think kids now, though, a lot of kids are more into money now. Is that true? I wonder if I'm just sort of making that up. After all, it wasn't any idyllic time, the 50s. Wasn't really the good old days in most ways, though sometimes I'd like to think it was. Things were simpler, that's for sure. There were fewer choices to make. There were fewer things available, fewer avenues to walk down. Now there's 1,000 things to do. I mean, just take TV. There was, I don't know what, there was 11 channels, not 1 million in 11 channels. And that's how it was. But I guess, you know, it hasn't changed a whole lot. People still want to be musicians. They want to be dancers. But when it comes to making money, just to being very, very rich, I think there's more of that now than there used to be. I think there's a lot more people who go to school to get degrees and then go on and want to get masters in business administration and maybe become bankers and hedge fund. And, of course, the big new thing is to become tech billionaires, you know, to invent software or hardware, to invent something. And it happens. You see people, it happens all the time. And kid, that's what kids want to do. But me, I wanted to be a cop. I wanted to be, particularly wanted to be a detective. I wanted to be a homicide detective and just a detective in general. I wanted to track down bad guys. I wanted to find bad guys. I wanted to chase them wherever they would go. I would never rest. And I would, you know, and there are always police shows. You know, there are always cop shows. But this is not something I got from watching. There weren't a lot of police shows on when I was a kid. Weren't that many, I should say, police shows on when I was a kid. There were police shows, but not like now. Not like CSI, you know, and fill in one of 52 different cities. It wasn't like that. But there were cop shows. There were always cop shows. There were private detective shows. But I had this desire. It was like a passion, like a mission. Oh, I should add, people also, some people wanted to be priests and rabbis, and I guess that still counts too. So the new thing in town is becoming a tech billionaire, to become somebody who invents software or goes into IT. Anyhow, so I wanted to track guys down. I wanted to, and it was always men, of course. You know, I wanted to find the bad guys. I wanted to find them no matter where they ran, no matter how they tried to get away, and I wanted to find them. I wanted them to be brought to justice, and I was the guy who was going to do it. If anybody could do it, I could do it. I would have an instinct for it. I would find them and I would bring them to justice. I didn't have in my mind shooting anybody. this is not what I wanted to do. I didn't want to be a patrolman. I never wanted to wear a uniform. I wasn't really into the uniform so much, and I wasn't into the patrolling on the street. I wanted to skip that part, of course. Always take the easy way out, right? But it wasn't until I learned later on. I thought you could, when I was a kid, I thought you could just join the police force and almost instantly become a plainclothes, you know, detective and pursue bad guys. The main thing was I was going to find men, particularly, who had done something wrong or something horrible and had to be brought to justice, said something awful to women and children. That's what I was going to do. And I didn't go so far from it. I mean, I came close to it in certain ways, which I can tell you about it later on. I did become a probation officer, and I worked for Brooklyn Family Court, and I worked other cases, hundreds and hundreds of cases over the years. I worked for the city and worked for the state. And I did actually, in some cases, supervise or recommend sentences for. In some cases, I tracked down missing bad guys, people who had beat up their wives and who had beat up their kids, men who had committed incest in their families, child molesters, people like that. And I tracked them down when they went missing. And I found them. Now, it wasn't our job as probation officers to haul out the gun and say, freeze, you're under arrest. We didn't carry cuffs and we weren't supposed to carry guns. Although I loved my badge and gun. I absolutely loved my badge and gun. But that's what I wanted to do. And but I didn't want to hurt anybody. I didn't see myself as a patrolman with a uniform on. I didn't see myself, I didn't like uniforms. I just wasn't, I wasn't that kind of guy. I was in the Boy Scouts, and I never liked wearing the uniform that much. There was something about uniforms that bothered me. I don't know what it was. And I didn't want to carry a stick, a nightstick, and I don't want to hit anybody. And I certainly didn't want to shoot anybody. So I lived in this strange world where I was going to be a detective and go after some of the worst criminals. Don't have a little water here, all right? Some of the worst criminals on earth, right? You know, serial killers and general, you know, really bad people, people who terrorize their neighborhoods, people who were the bane of the city, and I would track them down. But actually, I never want to hurt anybody, which, of course, does not go together. There is no way to avoid being a patrolman if you want to be a detective, ultimately. So, but did I know that? I don't even know if I really understood that. I didn't understand it. And later on, of course, the 60s arrived. So that was the end of that. My desire to be a cop lasted from when I was around, 13 or 14. And there were always, you know, cops in the comic books, right? Cops in the comic books. And my desire to be a cop was from when I was like 14 or 15, up until I would say when I graduated from college, when I was 21 or 22, because then it was the 60s and the cops all seemed to be on the wrong side. As far as detectives goes, they were still out there. You know, I still had a fondness for detectives in a way, or soft spot, something I wanted to do. And I was, my job was an investigator for the welfare department. They called them investigators in those days. But you would determine where people, you know, what people were doing, and you would unearth the truth of things. But it was hopeless. And once the 60s started and all the anti-war demonstrations, which I was in, and the civil rights demonstrations, which I was in, it was always the cops on the other side. They always seemed to be on the wrong side of things. And it wasn't so simple, of course, in some ways. And in some ways, it really was that simple. The cops are generally conservative people. They are the ones who uphold the laws and rules of society, no matter how bad or how wrong or how evil even those rules are. But that's not something I thought of. The cops out of my neighborhood, which I think I've mentioned a couple of times, were, was it last week I think I talked about them, where they're sort of these roly-poly old Irish cops. And since there was no crime in my neighborhood, we never saw a cop rough anybody up. We never saw anybody get insulted or yelled at. Or cursed at by a cop. The cops did not have to use violence in my neighborhood because there was hardly any crime. What it was like, now my neighborhood was a white neighborhood. Most neighborhoods when I was growing up in the 50s were segregated neighborhoods in the midst of the city. A lot of them are now, but it was particularly that way. It's almost as if there was a little invisible wall between neighborhoods. So I don't know, of course, what went on in black neighborhoods with mostly white cops. And in those days, there were very few black police officers or Latino police officers at all. It was almost entirely, maybe it was 99% white cops, mostly Irish and some Italian and others. And the very occasionally a black police officer. I'm talking about the 50s now. And even into the 60s and 70s, it was mostly was white cops. And I had no idea what went on in black neighborhoods. I had no idea. But I knew what it was like to be on the other end of the implacable and almost out of control violence of the cops in the 60s when I went to anti-war demonstrations. A lot of these demonstrations were illegal. You know, we didn't have a parade permit. We didn't have a permit to demonstrate any place. So, you know, permit, who needs? I don't need no stinking permit. We didn't need permits. We were citizens of the United States. We were free. We were against the war. We were for civil rights. We could do what we liked. It was our, you know, and I still feel that way. It was like the Occupy movement, right? Whose city is it? Whose country is it? Anyhow, the cops always were on the other side. And that was the end of my desire to have anything to do with the police force was then. But I have to say, and I knew a lot of cops in the probation department. When I was a probation officer, I met many cops in the course of my work. I had to interview cops who arrested what were called offenders. The cops called them perpetrators or perps, or they called them scumbags or whatever the cop name was for them. And I met a lot of undercover officers who – and these guys were really – a lot of them were really crazy. And a lot of them had an impulse towards towards putting people away, putting people away who they thought were dangerous to society, were just plain old scumbags. It was far, far exceeded anything that I ever had when I was a kid. These guys were passionate about it. For them, it was a religious mission to track down, and they would do anything even though they were the police, they were constantly breaking laws and rules to put people away who they knew were guilty of things. They absolutely knew. And a lot of times they were right. You know, they would frame people, which they shouldn't have done, and put people in jail for years, which they shouldn't have done. And you notice a lot of people getting out of jail now for faulty evidence or bad representation of attorneys. But a lot of it is bad evidence and faulty evidence, where witnesses are coming forward, and of course there's DNA. But the cops I knew in the probation department, they would plant drugs on people all the time. If they wanted to catch a dealer, they wanted to, and you know, it wasn't so much just regular citizens that they were after. A lot of these undercover cops worked in some really crummy neighborhoods, and they could never bring down a big dealer. And sometimes they would just plant drugs on them, and at least they would put them away for a while. So, they told me, you know, they had weapons that they planted on people, and they showed me. Some of these cops would show me the weapons. They'd show me the drugs they had taped to their ankles or in their some hidden pocket that they could find. And when they were searching somebody, they put drugs on them. So this is how I got to know cops. But even though at that point I had a very dim attitude because of probation, when I met a lot of these cops, it seemed to be like crazy and more dangerous than some of the criminals I met. And, you know, completely out of their minds, some of them. And the cops, of course, that I was, you know, that had hit me with nightsticks when I was trying to demonstrate against the war, when I was demonstrating against the war. So, but I have to say that I loved my badge and gun. When I was the closest I ever got to being a cop was a probation officer. And I had, when I was a state probation officer, I had a police officer. I had a badge that looked exactly like my childhood dream, a New York City detective badge. It was blue and gold. It was blue and gold, not just that silver or steel looking badge that regular police officers have, patrol officers, or people who haven't been promoted to detective. But the badge I had was this really terrific blue and gold enamel badge. And it looked exactly like a New York City police detective's badge. And I pinned it into my wallet so that anytime I opened my wallet to pay for lunch, to pay for the movies, anytime I took my wallet out, and I seemed to find many, many reasons why I could take my wallet out, people would see this and I would feel this tremendous amount of awe and respect. I'm sure there were other feelings that people had towards me, but they shut their mouths about it. And I did look a little bit like a cop. I had a sort of a violent aura about me anyhow, despite the fact that I never would have done anything to anybody. But I had this violent aura about me. And I also had a kind of a look on my face, sort of like, are you talking to me? That kind of look, like a look of authority, a look like I was representing, like I was a walking superego. I had that look on me because actually I was just broadcasting my own terrible conscience. And I was looking at other people with, you know, and it was coming through my eyes and people could see. Sometimes I would be riding on the bus or in a neighborhood, passing through a neighborhood, and automatically people in the neighborhood, a black neighborhood or Latino neighborhood, would look at me and, you know, so it's the cops, right? One time I'm on the bus going through a Latino neighborhood up in the Bronx, and one woman said to another, "Policia, policia," right? Yeah, I look like a cop. But I did, I have to say, I loved my badge. And then I went and bought a gun. They didn't really want us to have guns. They weren't expecting us as probation officers. We were not the kind of probation officers that that routinely went and supervised people who had, you know, had been placed on probation. And sometimes people would turn up and we had to go looking for them, and it could turn into a confrontation. That wasn't the kind I was. I was what's called a pre-sentencing officer. In those days, they would use us to investigate the case and go into neighborhoods and interview people who were victims and interview the perpetrators of crimes, a lot of them who had already confessed to being guilty. So this is before the judge sentenced them. They would give us the case, and they didn't expect us to use guns. We didn't expect us to need guns. We had no training. But as soon as I got my badge and my ID, I went right out to a gun shop on Hempstead, Long Island, And I went in there with all the cops, and I got myself a gun. I got myself a 38 revolver, an old-fashioned Chief Special, which you can't even see. Nobody even uses them anymore. They're considered completely inaccurate. But to me, it was back in those days, it was still a gun that people you would see on TV or in the movies. Or it was a gun actually that some detectives use. Often detectives use these guns. And I bought it, and I bought a box of bullets. And first thing I did is I walked right across the street. I was so excited. I tried not to show it, not to show like I was a kid at a candy shop or I was fulfilling some crazy warped childhood dream. I'm in this store with all these cops. The other thing about being a cop was, now that I think about it, was that when you're a cop, cops seemed like firemen, but especially cops seemed like men's men to me. And especially me, I grew up, basically I was a woman's man. I was a ladies' man. You know, I was raised by women. I did not have, anything that resembled a tough guy attitude or even a kind of aggressive masculine attitude. Just got that when I was later on, but still it was acting as if. Inside, you know, I had plenty of opportunities to identify with women in a family that was completely run and dominated by women. But the idea of cops were men, you know, they were real men. You know, cops were, U.S. Marshal, you know, detective this and detective that. They were men. That's another thing I got out of it. So I went and got, I bought my gun and I bought my box of bullets. And to me, it was the biggest deal in the world, right? Wow. I had a loaded gun and a badge. And to them, it was nothing. You know, what do you want? Here's your box of bullets. Okay, that'll be, you know, whatever it was, $122.38. Thank you very much. Goodbye. That was it. And I had brought cash out to pay for it. I went right across the street. There was a coffee shop across the street. I went right into the men's room, into a stall, and immediately opened the box of bullets and loaded this gun and put the gun in the holster that I had just bought and put it in my belt. And I was wearing a suit jacket, rather a sport jacket, and went out and sat at the counter. And I thought, well, and that's it. Now I'm really a man. But there was something about it. I loved having that feeling. I know this is completely contradictory. And this is during the time, you know, when I already had a bad attitude towards cops because of the 60s and a bad attitude towards the cops I met in jail. But this is all a personal dream for me come true, to be finally a person of authority, to be a man with a badge and a gun, right? And for me, it was power, authority. I mean, it was also people I thought could be afraid of me. So I spent most of my life being afraid of everybody. I was a smaller kid. I didn't get, you know, whenever there was a fight, I used to run away. But now I had my badge and gun. People couldn't mess with me. And it was a question of authority and of control. It was like a shortcut to power, and I had it. And the other thing about it, too, was that one reason I wanted to be a cop and I felt good about this was because now I could protect other people. Because I grew up in a completely unprotected way. Completely unprotected way. I always felt like I was in danger and I always felt unsafe. There was no man in my house. There was no men in my family practically worthy of the name. And, even though I didn't live in a dangerous place, I felt that I was in need of protection. And finally, somebody to watch over me, somebody to keep tabs on me, somebody I knew would always be watching me so that I would be safe. And now I was that guy. I really felt good about that, that I finally could be that guy, that I had that authority. Why don't we go to a little music and we'll come back. Anybody out there? Yeah, that feeling of being on guard. The thing I loved about when I was with my kids, when my kids were little, I loved putting them to bed. And then, you know, when my wife would go to bed, and my ex-wife now, I would stay up late in the living room. And it was such a beautiful feeling. It was a feeling I never had. Not once in my life did I ever have that feeling when I was growing up and even when I was older. But I was able to feel that feeling. I, you know, the doors locked and people would, you know, they would have to come through me. The devil himself could not get through me to get to my kids when I was up and watching over them. And I think they had that feeling too when they were young, that they would go to sleep and they knew somebody was watching over them, somebody was protecting them. And it was the greatest feeling in the world. I mean, if I think back of all the wonderful feelings I've ever had in my life, that's probably one of the best feelings I ever had, was the one that I could provide that protection. And for once, it satisfied that terrible feeling of unsafety in me that I had. But, you know, I wasn't the only one who, and I am not the only one, who is absolutely fascinated with God. Well, there was one thing I forgot to mention. Why is it, I mean, I'm telling you why I wanted to be a cop. But it's fascinating why people want to become cops. Sometimes it's just a family business. You could see that a lot in police shows or police novels, or if you've known cops, half the people in their family, their father, their uncles, their brothers, for generations were cops. So they go into the business. It's like a family business. And, you know, they get connected in the department. They can rise easier through the ranks. They could get better assignments. And it's just something they understand, right? They understand about, you know, being a police officer is like, it's like a family business, like a craft or something that's passed down. So that's one reason. Another reason is deep psychological reasons. A lot of people have become cops, if it's not in the family already. They become cops to set the record straight, to set some sort of psychological or emotional or familial record straight. There's something maybe that happened to them, or something that they didn't get, or some terrible injustice that occurred, maybe some violence in their family, and they have to get even. If you ever read any James Ellroy novels, you can get a strong sense of that. I don't think anybody has ever written about what motivates cops to become cops and to act the way they do than James Ellroy, who's a master crime novelist. He's the kind of writer, either you'll love his stuff and be addicted to it instantly, or you'll hate it. He has a very particular, almost run-on, nutty style, but he's really a terrific writer. And his own mother, Elroy's mother, was murdered, and it was an unsolved murder. And cops were involved in it, an unsolved murder. And he has a hero in this, and maybe you've seen this movie, L.A. Confidential. Russell Crowe's in the lead part, from the novel by James Ellroy. Maybe never a better novel about why somebody is driven to be a police officer, in his case, to protect helpless children and helpless women against brutal men, which is what happened to him when he was growing up. He was the victim, and so was his mother, of brutality of men. And you get a lot of that, where a lot of cops, at least the ones I used to know, I don't know about now, a lot of cops I knew, their fathers were brutal guys, and there were often beatings in the house. And there were slaps, there was punches, there was kicks, there were belts used. Their mothers were beat up, they were beat up, and later on, they spent their lives tracking down and getting even with the bad guys and beating them up and locking them up and making their lives miserable. So it all seemed to work out. But, you know, there's always been a fascination, obviously, with detectives and the cops. I don't know how many people listening to me right now feel this, too. Maybe you've had experiences with the cops or with the police, and you don't share this at all, or you don't have any kind of respect for the police, if you've still got some leftover 60s stuff that is unresolved. But And I must say that a lot of us who came up against the cops in the 60s have an attitude towards the police which will probably never fade away. You know, you can grow out of it, obviously, but there's something in there. There's something in there. But this fascination with crime and punishment and detectives, I mean, it goes all the way back, tracking down and finding criminals, finding the bad guys, protecting society. I even wrote my I didn't finish it, but I wrote about 95% of a master's thesis in my English literature course, going for a master's in English literature on detectives. It was mostly on private detectives, but this is and I read all sorts of detective books in my life, modern ones, old ones, even the first ones back in the 19th century. But now, but there's that fascination. Why is it so fascinating to see this? Because all of us inside, I believe, have a sense of what is justice and what is injustice. And we see it, maybe we've seen it in our lives a lot. We've seen it in our personal lives when we were growing up, in our lives currently. We've seen it in our families. We've seen society, God knows. I mean, look at the inequalities in society. The injustice in society is overwhelming. Now, of course, if you're black and the cops have always been white, it's always been bad. It's always been bad. Are things worse now because we see them, on video all the time, and there are actual films or still photographs or actual films of the cops doing things? Does that mean things are worse than they used to be? I think things once were worse than they are now. I think because cops are held accountable and because of advances in society, because the moral arc of justice, because the moral arc of the universe bends towards justice, I think cops are less able to get away with stuff that they used to get away with. I mean, way up into the 70s, and even into the 80s, cops were getting away with incredible stuff. And now when we see them getting away with these terrible murders and these racist kind of behavior, it's documented, but I think it's probably not as bad as it used to be. Still, it's awful. If you're black and, you have this experience with the white cops, this is what you have to deal with all the time. It's the way you grew up, and it's still that way all the time. It's still that way all the time. Look at who gets locked up in this country, mostly black men. And look who, but more and more cops are black, more police chiefs down south are black, more police executives are black. Things are changing, and now Latino, and now women are police officers. But I learned back, in the 60s when I was becoming disenchanted with the police and with cops entirely, and I studied history finally. In college, you finally study history, and then in graduate school, and then you read books on your own, you study history. That cops have always been on the side of money and power. And that's the way that the cops have always been. If you look at the news, you see that the cops are always on the side in every country. The police are always on the side. They are not representatives of the poor. They are not representatives of the minorities in countries. They are not representatives of anybody who is disenfranchised, who's low on the totem pole. The cops are really there to protect property as much as people. What was it during the Newark riots in the 60s? The mayor of Newark, I forget who it was, said that, his determination for whether the police would shoot at anybody during looting was if they were actually taking property, it was a shooting offense. The cops were allowed to shoot them if they were taking property. I mean, it wasn't that that maybe people were, people who were shooting at the cops, they shot back at them. People who were using the riots as an excuse for just sheer violence, the cops had a right to draw their weapons and maybe to use their weapons. But this guy made it pretty clear that any property that was being taken, the police were able to, as far as he was concerned, the police were allowed, they had a right to use their weapons on people. And that's really where it's at. The cops everywhere represent essentially power. They represent the power, and power is generally concentrated. It's conservative, and it has to do with property. It has to do with money. You know, and if you study the history of cops, cops have always been on the wrong side of things. When all the way back to the 19th century, when you started to have strikes and people first started to try to form unions, the cops were the ones who broke up the unions. And if it had to be private cops like the Pinkertons, they were hired to use violence. They were deputized to use violence by the authorities. And the Pinkertons and other private police forces and state militias and local police departments would beat people up and beat people to death just for the idea of gathering to form a union. When in New York City, on the Lower East Side, when my grandparents were growing up and they were forming the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, this is all around, you know, the events like the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. I think that's 1907. I don't remember exactly. The cops would ride down on them or wade in, you know, with their nightsticks. These are women picketing places where, because they were being worked, they're made to work, you know, 6-7 days a week, 12, 14 hours a day with no breaks or whether with a 5-minute break to jam some food down their throats. Doorways were locked, you know, windows weren't open. There was no air. I mean, working conditions, miners who went on strike, there were children working. They would work 7 days a week, places in West Virginia, in Kentucky. People were working, children were working. There was no child labor laws. And any time that people got together to protest this, any time people wanted to form a union or to demonstrate or to even peacefully, just peacefully picket outside of a manufacturer's, outside of a factory where clothing was being made or outside of a mine where coal was being dug out of the ground, the cops would come in, private cops and public cops would come in and wade in and use violence to make these people obey the rules and the laws as set by the owners of these companies. The cops were as much working for the owners of companies, large companies, steel companies, coal companies, clothing companies, any big business. They were as much working for them as they were working for the government. And of course, you had to conclude, and you wouldn't be far wrong, would you? And it's the same way to this day, that really there's no difference between the government and big business. And it's as much that way or more that way now than it's ever been before. There's nothing subtle about it. When it comes down, when you look at the Occupy movement, which no longer exists, basically, you see that people were, finally had enough about all this income inequality, which gets worse all the time, despite the fact that, who was it, McDonald's or Walmart raised the minimum wage a couple of dollars, which still leaves, huge portions, talking about tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people still making money at a poverty level so that the rest of us, our tax money has to support them. They get food stamps. They get all kinds of, aid from people, from the government. And essentially, Walmart itself, through not paying its employees enough, gets welfare from the government of billions of dollars. If our tax money goes to Walmart and goes to McDonald's because they refuse to pay people a living wage. And you see what happened during the Occupy movement, where the cops were, fairly patient because everything was so visible. This is the age of complete visibility. You saw that the cops were fairly tolerant in the beginning, but in the end, they had enough of it. And since the public wasn't paying attention, and since the newspapers couldn't care less because they were part of big business and they weren't interested in seeing people reclaim their land or reclaim their own property, the city they lived in, wherever it was, the cops were able to get away with wading in on people and beating people up, smashing people's possessions and absolutely everything. It was astounding. So this is what happened. The cops were always on the side of And when it came to women's voting rights, you know, or when it came to women marching in the 19th century, in the early 20th century, to march for votes, the cops would beat them up too. The cops would beat them up too. And finally, you know, it took a tremendous amount of blood lost and a lot of pain and a lot of suffering and a lot of deaths before people's attitudes changed. And people were allowed to form unions. But you could always count on the fact that even to get together to form a union, the cops would show up to break it up. The cops would show up to break it up. But we need cops, don't we? Doesn't society need cops? How do you feel? You live in a town, you live in a city. How would it feel to you if all of a sudden all the cops, as it happened once in Boston, by the way, the police went on strike. In Boston, in the early part of the 20th century, it was around 1919 or something like that, the cops actually went on strike. They went on strike. They did not come to work because they were being paid so miserably, I mean, really badly, and being made to work, you know, outrageous hours. And there was, of course, there's lots of laws that say the police aren't allowed to go on strike because that would be chaos and anarchy. But how would you feel if suddenly the cops in your neighborhood, wherever it was, a part of the city or in your town where you live, they just decided that they weren't being treated right? And cops don't get paid very much. They get paid much better in some places than other places. In a place like New York City, they don't get paid very much at all. And of course, the less the cops get paid, the more is a tendency towards corruption. That's obvious, right? It's always a better idea to pay them a decent living wage, you know, or whatever that would you might call that these days. But how would you feel if there suddenly were no cops? We need cops. Why? Because there are bad people. Because there are bad people. There are bad people in the world. There always will be bad people in the world. And, of course, this gets abused all the time. It gets abused all the time because the cops have to be controlled. The cops have to be controlled. The cops are, you know, are servants of the people. But as we've always seen, and as they still are, they are servants of the people who have money and power. Cops, a lot of cops have violent impulses. That's why they become cops. And now we're seeing the videos and the still photographs to prove it. But we do need the police. These are things that we won't do ourselves. We don't want to do. And a lot of us don't have this violent impulse. A lot of us don't have the courage. A lot of us don't have the impulse to be, to put themselves in danger to protect other people like that. They don't have that violent impulse. And so we have the police to do the things we don't want to do, just like the fire department. I mean, how many of us are willing to, you know, to race to a fire and walk into a fire and try to put out a fire and save people? It's really unusual. And we're glad that these people exist. And for the same reason, I think a lot of us are glad that the cops are there, because there's a lot of, I mean, if they weren't around where I lived, believe me, there would be people being mugged and robbed. It's not like such a bad neighborhood, but it would happen quick. I mean, it would happen quick. But the point is, the cops have to be controlled. You want the cops to be controlled and to go after the right criminals, to go after the politicians and the lobbyists and the hedge fund manipulators and the bankers and the crooked lawyers and the people who are really ruined, who are really the bad criminals, the people who create poverty, the people who perpetuate poverty. The cops should be arresting the heads of Walmart, not the people who, you know, who get paid $9 an hour and finally have to shoplift something, and then the cops show up and put them in handcuffs or maybe shoot them if they try to run. Cops have to be set after the right people. You know, if they go after the right people and if they're controlled, then it's a good thing. But yeah, yours truly, I always wanted to be a cop. I always wanted to be a cop. But cops have to be controlled too. They have to be screened, they have to be paid enough, and they have to keep their impulses under control. The cops. We need them, and we feel pretty strange and, you know, and complicated about them. But when these videos come out, it really stirs things up. It really stirs things up. And you see things from a black person's point of view if you're white. Finally, you see what it's like. All right, that's it for this week. I'm glad to be talking to you, and I'll see you next week.
walk through the garden, you better watch your back. Well, I beg your pardon for the straight and narrow track. If you walk with Jesus, he'll save your soul. You gotta keep the devil down in the hole. He's got the fire and the fury at his command. Well, you don't have to worry if you hold on to Jesus' hand. We'll all be saved from Satan when the thunder rolls. You gotta keep the devil. Devil.